Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast in our Week in IndyCar episode with my friend Eric Bretzman, Andretti Autosport Technical Director. Not coming off a bad weekend here with the duel in Detroit, my man. Tell me what's the general feeling within the shop, knowing not only how competitive you guys were, but also our man, Mr. Hunter Ray, got a very large monkey off his back getting into victory lane.
A lot of smiles on the face. A lot easier drive home from Detroit. Lots of shoulders look like there's some weight off them. Everybody's flying a little higher this week.
Let's look at some of the trends and things that we saw in Detroit. Then let's also move into Texas a little bit, what we think might be ahead this weekend. Then we have a whole bunch of awesome questions that have come in. So we're not going to try and blow past Detroit or Texas, but I want to make sure we get to as many questions as possible. Let's start, Eric, with decision-making. So as Mike Hull mentioned, after Scott Dixon's win on Saturday in the first race, really came down to a question of who could make a two-stop work best, who could make the three-stop work best, and the three-stop routine was looked like it was a little bit of a stretch, but then we saw on Sunday that, boy, Mr. Hunter Ray and company certainly were doing quite well, but just going into a race like this, where you know it could be a two-stopper, could be a three-stopper, how do engineers like yourselves and strategists pick one or the other? And then with a four-car team, do you guys, try and say, hey, driver A, B, C, or D, which way are you feeling? Maybe we'll go in different directions across some of the cars.
Yeah, I would say in first day for sure, race one, I would say in no way, shape, or form did we go in expecting it to go by the book where somebody said they were going to do a two-stop and they did a two-stop, and nobody said we're going to do a three-stop and did a three-stop. Race one's a bit of a fact-finding mission, right, to see how the Reds are going to play out, see what the pace of the Reds really is 10 or 15 laps in. We did a, not a long run, but like a qualifying sim, and then filled the car up, one of the cars up on Friday, and ran the Reds for a while to get an idea. But you just never know when you start with sticker Reds. Is it the pace going to be such that you can make it or not? You don't know if the pack's going to get grouped back up with a yellow. You need to be able to pit into clean track if you're going to do a three stop. Maybe there's no clean track. Maybe you just have to tough it out. We just kind of prepared ourselves across all cars to do a two or a three. And in some cases, you get 8-10 laps in and the red tires just weren't making it on one particular car with a particular driver in the situation he was in, and opportunity presents itself to change the plan and you go for it. So across four cars we did have a bunch of opportunities to do different things just naturally. So in the end it worked out, but race two is kind of interesting, right, because we ended up with two cars at the front at the end doing two different things.
Oh yeah.
So it's, things still have to play out. Who would have guessed their race would have gone, caution free like it did for so many laps, and it just allowed it to play out, fair and square without any other variables in the mix. So I would say we go in prepared to adapt, take opportunities when we see them. We kind of can suggest here and there based on starting spots, odds are the guy at the back will be able to be looking for something a little more radical or a little more different to improve his position, and we kind of sell that a little bit inside the race team. But you really got to take it as it comes and make the most out of the opportunities.
And that's an interesting thing to discuss a little bit deeper, Eric. I think some folks might look at an IndyCar team or a professional racing team in general and think that there's a lot of carryover maybe from some other professional sports where, the head coach, the offensive coordinator maybe has X amount of plays and they're regimented and they call them into the quarterback and that's the play that must be run. In this dynamic, knowing that, whether it's weather, tire life, fuel load. There's so many variables that are constantly moving throughout the course of a race. It is hard to say, no, we're sticking to the pre-formed plan and just do it. That isn't how things work, or at least work successfully, right? There's not a lot of telling a driver, no, you must do a two-stop or three-stop. Just tell us a little bit about the organic way these conversations evolve, maybe even just during the race. Hey, what do you think? Tell me. Give me your feedback. It's a little warmer than being a general shouting instructions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to think about it as, it starts out with starting positions, right? Like, if you're on pole, you got to probably go with the highest percentage, most clean cut race. You know, if you're up in the points, same thing, right? If you're looking for a spark and looking to do something different, if you qualify 10th, 12th, 15th, you're not going to just pass your way to the lead in a straight up race, right? Like you have to give yourself an opportunity to go faster than the other cars. Right, you need clean track, you need to just run. The situations just aren't the same if you're starting first or starting 10th or starting 20th. The race strings out after four or five laps, starts to, even that quickly, it starts to kind of take shape, right? I think we had some cars pitting that early to just switch over to get on the three stopper.
Yeah.
As other people do what they do, suddenly there are cars that are running on track where you might come out if you pit, right? So if they're not running as fast as you need to run, you either need to run faster before you pit so you come out in front of them, or come up with something else, right? Like stay where you are and do what you can. Every car on track impacts the leader's race. Every car on track impacts everybody's race, really, especially if you look at like the track following software during the race at Detroit. It was green for so long, there were cars everywhere. and if there's a pack of four or five cars following nose to tail, they might only be separated by 3 seconds, and if you're at the back of the pack, you might just take an opportunity to pit early or stay out late and try and get three laps that are a second a lap faster, so when you come out of the pits, you're ahead of them.
Yeah.
It's hard to pass them out, right? So, we race on pit lane too.
So if we look at how Andretti Autosport performed as a team last weekend, I would say it was, I don't want to say breakout performance, right? Because we've seen, Rossi was in the hunt at St. Pete. Obviously, he was the past master general at Phoenix. I know that, he didn't win there, but we saw Rossi was quick there. We go to Long Beach, obviously, Rossi won. Hunter Ray second at Barber. You guys have been there, thereabouts a lot. Do have a win on the board prior to Detroit. Marco sets pole for race one. You guys finish second and third, win again on Sunday with Hunter Ray. I mean, what's the general feeling coming out of Detroit, Eric? You have to feel like, I'm assuming that you feel like, we've got something here that can contend for a championship. I mean, that's at least what I'm seeing.
Yeah, and it's not about one guy. We want to go into this championship fight the last three, four races with a couple guys up there, and to get to that point, the whole platform across all cars has to be, hitting on all cylinders and contributing to the team as a whole, right? Everybody's got to be getting through their test plans. Everybody's got to be pushing each other on pit stops. The race engineers all have to be pushing each other on preparation and helping each other get ready for all these different events that we're going to for the first time with the new body kit. Especially us, a lot of these tracks we haven't tested at. We didn't do any of the preseason development work or anything for the series, and we can't really afford any weak links, right? Like everybody's got to be pulling the rope.
So if we're looking at how things did play out, obviously Rossi has, his Sunday didn't go according to plan in the final lap, so his 12th place finish is actually his worst of the year. So, again, for those who watched both races or even just Sunday's race, that was the abnormality for him. Prior to that second race, every single finish was inside the top five except for Barber, which is, fairly astounding in terms of consistency. Hunter A, as well, has been quick. A whole bunch of fifth places, a pair of seconds, finally a win. It was great to see him get back on track. Marco, as well, hasn't been as sharp, but is sitting eighth in points. And Zach Veach, 15th. I mean, he's second among the rookies. If you, you know, Robert Wickens is technically a rookie, but, you know, we would say that based on his age and experience, you know, Zach might be the first of what we would consider the true rookies. So as a whole, it looks like you guys are fairly sharp. Tell me a little bit about Sunday, though, and, you know, a finish to the race that was partially satisfying, sure, with Hunter Ray winning, but it could have been a 1-2. How does a team like yours, or maybe any other large team, process something where, you know, we could have had two cars with great points finishes, but ended up with only one? Do you just kind of put that out of your memory, or do you guys try and analyze that afterwards to make sure it doesn't happen again? How do you process?
Well, we spent a few minutes just looking at data and looking at some video footage to see where the brake locking came from, and you know, just from an engineering viewpoint, what was going on there, and we kind of can kind of paint the picture now. And like I say, that was probably until about 8:30 Monday morning was about all the time we spent on that. Maybe have a talk with the big boss and you know, kind of kick things around big picture wise, and the view of maybe what we could do different next time, and then straight on to Texas. You know, I think everybody learns pretty quick. Especially once the points that you could have had are gone, you know, maybe you have a different viewpoint on it after the fact. We'll just have to play that as it goes. But I mean, as a team, I was on the, just happened to be on the 28 stand this weekend. You know, so right there, and you know, to see the victory firsthand and be a part of them doing it there on the timing stand, and just see how happy everybody was to, you know, get that win for the first win in a couple of years, right? So that was a really big shot in the arm for that group. You know, but from kind of my job position, right, you know, looking at big picture, trying to stack the points up before the end of the year, you know, we can see where they went away. So, you know, that's disappointing, but nothing we can do about it now other than get them back at Texas.
Got a couple of folks who've asked for a little bit of a deeper explanation if anything was found with Rossi's car that might have contributed to the brake locking and such, so I'll save that for later if that's something you can get into. Let's move out of Detroit and look to Texas, Eric. So we saw on the super bumpy street course, we had lots of happy Honda drivers with the ability to put down, you know, good power, accelerate away. It was definitely a strong weekend for Honda Performance Development. Now we're moving to Texas, where we're going to have cars running, you know, high in the rev range, making, you know, peak power for the most part for quite some time, which has shown to be this season more in Chevy's wheelhouse. Is that something that you try and break down and analyze heavily as a race engineer if there's a discrepancy? Or do you just go into a weekend like Texas and say, well, all I can do is worry about our cars, and whatever happens in the engine bay, well, that's not really in our control.
Yeah, all we can do is worry about our cars and you know, help our partners when they're asking for data and you know, data, ideas, recommendations, thoughts. You know, we work pretty close with HPD on you know, they support us a bit on the aero side as well. So you know, that's a group we talk to, just like we do the engine side. So you know, and the engine guys are, of course, asking, you know, is there anything more we can do on the aero side? And but they're also saying, hey, we got some ideas on how we run the engines that might be better at Texas than it was at Indy. So, yeah, hopefully there's a little bit of a step there. But, yeah, the engines have characteristics to them, don't they? I think it's, we've seen that before. This isn't maybe the first time we've seen it. Yeah, the street course engine, for sure, right? You just look at the rankings on timing and scoring, and there was a lot of Hondas at the front. So I would say our drivability or usability is a little friendlier for the drivers. Maybe there's a bit more power in the right spots for that track. And, you know, Detroit's a little bit deceiving, though. Like, the average corner speed at Detroit is significantly faster than the rest of our street courses.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty darn fast track with lots of revs and long straights too. The other thing that's different is boost level. So the road course boost level versus some of the oval boost levels means the engine's operating in a totally different window in some cases. So, we don't think about engines as just ovals and road course spec, right? It's the different boost levels kind of come in and out of tune potentially between the manufacturers. So, yeah, that's pretty complex. We leave that mostly in HPD's hands. We work with a monitor and, try and support them with data and give them time to test things on the cars if they've got ideas. But really kind of in their hands, and we're going to figure out how to make the cars handle this weekend.
So you mentioned aero spec. Let's close on that, Eric. What are you and the other teams bound to use by IndyCar in terms of front and rear wing options, aero tuning options, and such that's different from Indy? And I ask that because Indy is a bit of a special place, but now that we're going to our first kind of high-banked 1.5 mile speedways, what's different about the aero package you're going to bolt on and what you have to work with?
Fundamentally, the downforce level is going to be the lightest we've seen. So it will be less than Indy qualifying by a good margin. So Texas has a little more banking to it, reasonably fresh pavement. Still kind of bumpy, but going to be really hot. It's going to be a bit slippery, but the difference in the cars, so we run the same front and rear wing, but there's a maximum wing angle of -6 degrees, so they'll be tipped up six degrees. In the oval, we were allowed to go all the way up to +2. So that's a couple hundred pounds of downforce reduction right there from Indy race. Moving lower on the car, the underwing, the diffuser exit walls are going to be missing. That's mandatory. We can't run the sidewalls on the under tray for Texas, and those are optional at Indy, and everybody ran them.
Yeah.
It's really, really efficient downforce. And then just to kind of make Texas a little more unique and, kind of go the direction IndyCar was wanting to go, there's also a special kind of a reverse gurney that hangs off the bottom of the floor in front of the rear tires that kills a little more downforce as well. Very few downforce generating devices left on the car, so it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
And I wouldn't ask you to comment on what or why, IndyCar arrived at this or what they might be thinking, but I mean, Texas is a place where we have seen that at least in the events shortly after the DW12 came out, where thoughts on, hey, let's take away a bunch of downforce and it'll get rid of pack racing, but maybe it'll make better racing and such. I don't know if that was fully achieved, Eric. If anything, it seemed like we had races where folks were just scrambling for downforce, burned off tires possibly because they had missed a setup window that was almost impossible to find. You've been there engineering cars, during that era. Is there anything about this very, very light downforce package, regardless of the banking in mind, that makes you think that, ooh, Saturday night might be one where drivers are having to hold on to steering wheels harder than ever?
Yeah, it's going to be pretty difficult. I would say they're going to be holding on harder than ever, especially, knowing the heat's coming. I think the rules are, their goal is to provide just the right amount of passing, right? You're trying to avoid the 3 wide, 4 deep, old time pack racing. And we're trying to do something that's exciting for everybody to watch too, and give drivers a chance to get up there and race with somebody. It's always hard too, knowing a track has just been repaved. What was the first winter like? How's the asphalt aging? We've got a new car coming out, for the second year of the track. Where's the grip level going to be on the pavement? Where's the grip level going to be with the tires? We're just getting to know the handling characteristics of the car. It's a tough ask to hit it right off the bat, but you know, fortunately with IndyCar and the type of cars that they are, like, we can bolt things back on and change things and if we need to and make it right. That's something we can do quick. Yeah, I know we're going to go into the weekend prepared to adapt if we have to, but yeah, I think it'll be super slippery. I remember it might have been the 2012 or 2013 race. We were leading with Dixon, and it was, I don't know, at one point we were probably two-thirds of the way into a tire run, and everybody's starting to slow down, and I think he was still running like 7 miles an hour faster than some of the other cars, and he ends up crashing in the middle of turn four. And even though he crashed, he got out, he's like, man, that was so much fun. Like, it was just a blast. He's like, but we just crashed. He's like, yeah, but it, holy cow, like, you really had to drive it. But at some point, I'm afraid if it just becomes pure survival, it just isn't really in the spirit of, you know, the fast, awe-inspiring Indy cars.
Fast, awe-inspiring Indy cars. I love the sound of that. All right. Well, let's dive in to some listener Q&A, my man, and as we do every episode of The Week in IndyCar, we start off by picking my favorite question from the previous week and awarding them either a Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirt or mug, courtesy of our friends at torontomotorsports.com. I don't know, Eric, if you saw the Willpower DJ Willie P cartoon that they did leading into Detroit, but that was one of my favorites. But the good folks there at torontomotorsports.com take care of my listeners just fine. So picking my favorite question from last week, that will go to Christopher Logan, who asked the somewhat cranky Derek Daly to share his story of when Willie T. Ribbs introduced our Irishman to Muhammad Ali. And, yeah, that provided the great story came from that. So, Christopher, shoot me a DM here. Tell me what you'd like, a t-shirt or a mug. If it's a t-shirt, what size? And then hit me with your email address and mailing address, and we will get you sorted, courtesy of our friends at torontomotorsports.com. All right, Mr. Bretzman, let's see. Let's start off with Happer Labs coming in from Twitter. Did Alexander Rossi have brake failure at the end of race two in Detroit? From the onboard camera, it looked like the front's locked and the rears were still turning. Sudden failure of the brake balance system, perhaps, question mark? If you can share.
I can, yeah. Well, there's not a whole lot to hide because we put another set of tires on him. He went out and was running really fast at the end of So, yeah, no issues with the brakes there. Yeah, since they got another set of tires on the car, he was back going strong. Just looks like kind of changed up what he was doing. He had another car coming, and you know, it's not that he was gonna throw any kind of wicked block on his teammate, but you know, he was just doing everything he thought he could with his car position and his current situation, and looks like there's, you know, a different set of bumps where it really unweighted the car, and that's why, you know, we kind of see the outside front wheel lock, which is totally is a little bit strange. Yeah, it looks like it got lighter a couple of times, and you know, initially there was a small one, maybe like the lap or two before, and you know, once you get one, it's just way easier to get the next one.
So, oh, yeah.
It looks like that's all that kind of happened there. You know,
and Rossi is not the first driver, the last driver to have experienced such a thing. So there's nothing critical being said here, nor should there be anything critical leveled his way from a driving standpoint. I mean, I think just about everybody, whether it's in a race car or a road car, we've all locked a brake and probably flat-spotted something during some sort of accident avoidance. So, you know, it's happened to every race car driver.
Yeah, and it was a really deceiving situation too, right? Like Ryan was having a superhuman day, right? Like he was way faster than the field, and you know, you want to keep going, you assume that's how fast everybody else is going, but that wasn't really the case either. I think there was only Ryan and maybe one other car, maybe Will or somebody, that was even running faster than Alex was. Like Alex was still going fast. It just looked way different.
Yeah,
with Ryan coming into the camera, you know.
Absolutely. All right. I love this next question. This is coming in from Don Davis. Eric, did you ever get a B in an engineering course? And was there any other profession that you contemplated?
Yeah, I was lucky to get these in some classes. Yeah, definitely not a perfect record, that's for sure. I'll say that for future motorsports engineering grads, definitely want to kind of talk to your professors if you're out there going to races on weekends and missing a lot of Fridays and stuff. Sometimes you're not even there for the exams. So I had a lot of zeros factored in for tests. I wasn't quite there when I was off racing and doing things while I was still in school, but at least the average panned out.
And we're also, I'm hoping this weekend maybe we can find some time to record your contribution to my new podcast series I'm assembling in the background. So you want to be a blank in motor racing, and you've been kind to help with the, for those who do want to become a race engineer, technical director type, to offer some insights on your career path and education or schooling that you might suggest and other things to eventually become the next Eric Bretzman. So that's on the horizon.
You find me an air-conditioned room to do it in Texas, and I'll be there.
I have one. So, see, all of a sudden, people who haven't wanted to be interviewed are going to be lining up going, yeah, talk about whatever, idiot. It's cool in here. Come on. All right. Let's see. All right, Jordan Darwin, this is already a front-runner for my favorite question. For those of you who do know, Eric is not the only Bretzman family member engineering on the IndyCar pit lane. There is your brother Ben, a champion in 2016 with Team Penske, and Simon Pagenaud. And so Jordan Darwin asks, Eric, is the inter-family brother versus brother and or Andretti versus Penske rivalry strong? And would you like to work with your little brother, or do you like it being separate but still in the same series?
I think it's good right now. Someday I think it'd be super cool. But right now everybody's stretching their wings and in good situations, and then I think that's great. I like seeing them there every weekend. I like seeing them do well. It's also good to have a good rivalry too, right? Like if we could both finish 1-2 someday, you know, and then 2-1 and 1-2, it'd be great. Yeah, it's fun racing them. It's fun seeing them. But I would say most all our conversations are about my little niece and fishing in Florida and Milwaukee Brewer baseball and things like that. kind of leave the racing a little separate, you know.
Yeah, as you should. That's your day job. Who wants to talk? Who wants your day job to take over your personal life? Wait a minute. I'm not one to speak. All right. Eric Franklin says, "Are the fuel Buckeye and refueling apparatus controlled by the series?" I ask because it seemed impossible that Scott Dixon could be that much faster on Saturday's pit stops and still get the fuel fully loaded. So good question, Eric, but also, if you can take that one, but also an insight maybe on the fact that while filling the tank full is what many teams do, depending on the situation and where you're at in the race strategy-wise, there are teams that would also maybe skip the last proverbial gallon or two if it gains them track position that they might be able to exploit later.
Yeah. So the fuel cell is obviously the capacity is controlled by IndyCar, and its design's controlled by IndyCar. It's something we buy. We don't manufacture those. So before the race, all the cars go through fuel capacity and set the maximum capacity at the IndyCar fuel pump. So we know everybody's playing with the same size tank. The refueling probe, the refueling hose, the Buckeye, the valve in the car, those are all controlled parts we have to buy from a certain supplier, and they're serviced a couple times a year by that supplier. The pit tanks are all built the same to a drawing. There's a couple options there. You can run different valves on the pit tank, but everybody on pit lane has migrated to the same one now. So not a whole lot of difference there. It's not too big of a secret inside all the race teams that fuel flow can look faster if your guy goes out and plugs into the car sooner.
Yep.
So the fuel flow itself is probably the same rate within a couple percent between all the cars on pit lane. But the guys that get off pit lane first, if you kind of watch their pit stop again, you might see the fueler gets the probe in before the car even comes to a stop. And that could be the difference.
And that's a great point there. I know that back in the day when I was working with IndyCar teams, when I was on the timing stand, for example, not in every instance, but in a number of teams, there were bonuses. Because since, you know, all the stops were videotaped, if the refueler could plug in before the car had come to a stop, you know, it might be $100. If the, you know, tire changers could get that gun on the nut before the car had stopped, there could be a bonus. So I don't know if, you know, those bonuses are still a common practice, but to your point, folks aren't waiting for the car to come to a complete stop before touching it, which is required in, you know, sports car racing in many examples. But here, at least, you have the refuelers and the tire changers effectively chasing the car in and trying to get connected while it's still rolling during that last, you know, couple of feet. And if you can, you have just knocked some time off your pit stop for sure. So
yeah, it's not some. It can be a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, and then it gets really complex once the air jack gets plugged in, and suddenly now you have a moving target and two axis.
So that's why the sparks are shooting off the bottom of the air jacks. It's still skidding forward. I got it.
Yeah, yeah, well, that and you happen to pick out an example with a driver that might not need as much fuel as everybody else.
Yes, another brilliant point that while, you know, everyone comes in for fuel, if you have someone like Scott Dixon, who I've heard you might have worked with once before, he might not need as much fuel to fill that tank as some others, so that also would decrease the amount of time that they're sitting stationary. So, interesting. Let's see. Alan Bandy, a bit of a comment. In all seriousness, who let Francesco Dracone behind the wheel of the pace car? You got to feel bad for Mark Reuss there. You know, he does have FIA driver certification. Yeah, it was just a mistake. It was an embarrassing mistake. I mean, it added 40 minutes or whatever it was to get the race rolling again. But, you know, if nothing else, it's little things like these that we never forget. And we should at least thank the folks who create these memories. Eric?
Yeah.
Let's see. Corey Matthews asked about the Rossi incident, but which we covered, and then asked, am I going to do more Who the Hell Are Yous? Yes, Corey, I've been very delinquent in getting that started, but I do need to knock out a couple more questions. I'm not sure if I'm going to go with 50 brand new questions, because I think I have about 45 of them, or if I might blend some of the new ones into the original set of 50. So I think it's more that I'm trying to figure out. But once I do, I kind of sort of have the list of who I want to include in the interview rotation. Kyle Hebron asks, thoughts on Santino Ferrucci's IndyCar debut? He said Saturday's performance seemed far different from Sunday's performance. Not sure how to read into it. Among your duties during the weekend, did you happen to take a look and see what you might have thought of good old Connecticut's Santino Ferrucci in his Dale Coyne Racing debut?
Yeah, I can't honestly say too close, right? Was it the first day he kind of had a premature exit there, I believe?
Yeah.
Yeah, so kind of hard to say what was going to happen there. And we just never really came across him with too many of our cars, you know, on the second race there. I'd have to say judgment withheld at the moment.
I thought he did better than expected. It's funny because last year as well, we had Esteban Gutierrez making his Coyne debut at Detroit with, you know, effectively zero laps in the car. I believe Santino got a little bit of time at Putnam Park, but Coyne's had to drop new people into cars at Detroit, which might not be my first choice of how to introduce someone to IndyCar, and I think the kid showed some talent. I mean, clearly the Coyne guys were struggling this weekend in both races. Seb did not have the best of weekends by any stretch. Santino got knocked out of the first race. I don't think it was really a fault of his own by Charlie Kimball. Made a mistake in the second race. You know, did I see something that made me believe Roger Penske is going to fire Will Power, Joseph Newgarden, and Simon Pagenaud and offer their salaries to him? No. But did I see something that makes me hope The Haas Formula One team and Santino's manager finds another reason to get him in the series to give us a better look at, you know, I don't know, a mid-Ohio or Portland or Sonoma. I think that would be rather cool. All right, let's move on to Chuck Knob. Says, Eric, thoughts on the newly announced engine formula for IndyCar, and then also any special moment or memory from your Indy 500 win with that Scott Dixon guy?
Thoughts on the new engines. My first thought was, holy cow, how are we going to stop these things? They're going to be going really fast.
Well, you've opened up another couple questions that folks have asked about brakes, so maybe that's a good place to embellish a bit, too.
I think it's great, a great idea, great in concept. We just have to be careful how we manage the aero rules, how fast we really want to go at some of these tracks, and how the heck we're going to get them stopped. But I think it's a step in the right direction. The engine manufacturers think they can do it without costs escalating out of hand and keep other potential manufacturers interested. You know, as long as it stays a viable formula for other folks to come do it, that's great. You know, all about going faster and lighting some tires up here and there, but there's a lot of other variables that, you know, are going to have to come together to kind of keep everything in the right window.
What about your 2008 memories with that Kiwi guy?
One of the things I remember that was pretty funny was the last couple laps. If you replay the race, you can see him scooting down in the car, trying to get lower and lower for less drag. It was pretty fun.
Was that something he came up with on his own?
Totally on his own. He just thought that might be helping.
That is so cute. That is so cute. Let's see. Let's go to Jason Johnson on Twitter, who says, if you had to leave IndyCar to engineer in any other series in the world for 1 year, what would it be?
We'll stick automotive. And I tell you that if you didn't have to, if you could live with being gone all the weekends and the hours that on the road and just nonstop, like, I will say there is a lot of good racing going on in Cup, a lot of development. I mean, those guys are just cutthroat 36 weekends a year, 7 days a week, continuously.
And you got to spend,
that could be fun, but
you got to spend time there on the development side with the Chip Ganassi team before you came over to Andretti. So that's something you've definitely seen, but I guess from a race engineer, knocking out 36 race weekends plus all the testing and whatever. Yeah, it's kind of a single person's job, if you ask me.
Yeah, and that's kind of ruling out just because we're kind of participating in it now. The Australian supercar thing is pretty darn cool. Those cars are just fantastic. Big V8s in them still. It's nice. They're civilized. You can walk over, open the door, close the door. It's got door jams. It's got, you know, it's just very, very nice. Those are a lot of fun. They got splitters, big wings, great racetracks to run at. I think that would be super cool to do. Like I say, I kind of ruled that one out already because we've already got our finger in that pie a little bit and playing around there. So I get to see that. And that's been entertaining and different from what we do now. You know, not as many parts come out of the catalog, right? You're building your own frames, hanging your own bodies. I mean, it's to a spec, but you got to build your own cars.
Sean Olmsted, we'll stick with Twitter for a minute because you have you've got a particularly interesting insight you can offer. Sean asks, how tough is it to work with a rookie driver? And considering you have Zach Veach in the Andretti team this year as a true IndyCar rookie, and then you had some Spanish guy last year who was also, again, a true IndyCar Indy 500 rookie. He might have amassed 2 Formula One World Championships prior to that, though. But how tough can it be to work with a rookie driver? And how dependent is that the toughness part based on the experience they bring in?
Experience goes a long way, but I would say the thing that trumps it is attitude. You know, Zach is never giving up. He just keeps fighting. We've been able to keep him on track a lot, you know, out of the walls, keep getting your experience, build on things every week. You know, lots of opportunities for bad things to happen. And 2 races at Detroit, kept his nose clean and got a couple of respectable finishes for a rookie out of it. You know, that's what we're looking for. You know, on good days, it'll end up like, what was it, Long Beach? You got a fourth, right? You know,
yep.
That's where we want to play. You know, we want to be a solid 10th or 12th and move him up on the good days and, you know, kind of regroup, get some more testing in over the winter and take another notch forward next year. I would say that attitude and is the biggest thing, right? Willingness to come in here and sit here and go through the data on Monday and talk to his teammates and actually take in their input and, you know, let it register and, you know, look for help and apply it. I'd say attitude, right? And Fernando was the same way, right? So other end of the spectrum on experience, but he came in with the attitude of, I think this is really cool, I want to learn how to do it. And he asked all the questions, worked really hard at it, and, you know, was on pace for a really good result. But, you know, that probably comes from some experience and natural talent as well. But like I say, you know, the first thing you notice is the attitude of and the process. So I think those are the big things for the rookies.
I'm going to jump back to Facebook here, Eric. Justin Ford asked a question, and this one or two other folks have asked something similar, and this actually fits into a story that I'm writing. I write this time every year about how exhausted everybody is and what's different or how things improved. Justin Ford says, Eric, who or what goes back to the shop during a race weekend? Who stays behind coming out of a race weekend like this? And if everybody works all weekend, as they did at Detroit, do folks get Monday or Tuesday off with the upcoming race at Texas? Or how does this work?
Well, in this particular case, we all drove back from Detroit because it's about a 4.5-hour drive. I believe there was a small town along the way that has a significant blip in revenue for some speeding tickets Sunday night. There was a Honda Odyssey caravan going through there at a reasonable rate of speed. So everybody drove back. We got back to the shop about midnight, 12:30, somewhere in there. I showed back up for work Monday morning at 10 a.m. The shop-based guys had the trucks unloaded, front wings getting turned around, you know, because they're the same nose boxes and things that hold the Speedway wings on. So starting to go through parts. Saw, you know, shop-based guys had cars in the air, uprights coming off. You know, they got a couple-hour jump start on the road crew. A lot of the engineers had already come in, but fundamentally the road crew was supposed to come in at 10 a.m. and strip cars and kind of work till about 4 or so, and then we all got in early this morning and we'll go until we're done. Matter of fact, one of the trucks has already left for Texas.
Wow.
I was just looking out the window there. So it's a lot of hours today. We'll send the rest of the trucks in the morning, and the balance of Wednesday is effectively off for the road crew. Then we travel Thursday morning.
And then after the Saturday night race, there are some teams that are heading to Road America next week to test. So although there is a weekend off after Texas, basically the 24-hour Le Mans weekend prior to Road America, we also have some teams that are heading back out to test. So not everybody is necessarily taking, I don't want to say the week off, because no one takes a full week off, but there's some folks who are going to busy themselves right after Texas too. So yeah, there's a lot of folks just clamoring for a little bit of mental space, physical recovery, you name it. So this is just the ugly, ugly part of the season. Daniel Kincaid is bringing us back to the topic of brakes, and maybe we can expand a little bit here. He says, with the increase in power in 2021, what options are there to help from a braking standpoint? Curious, you know, whether it is larger discs, more pad surface, better cooling. What do you think we might be looking at for a braking package to deal with, in theory, a lot more top speed to shed in heading into whatever corner?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this early in the game, all of that's on the table, right? I mean, it could even go into playing into wheel size with Firestone. You know, maybe we end up on a 17-inch wheel, which would leave tons more room for brakes. That'd, you know, make the braking job a lot easier. But, you know, obviously that impacts a lot of other things. So, you know, I think right now everything's on the table, everything from wheel size to air scoop, you know, brake duct intake size. I think all that's on the table. Maybe even, you know, top flap changes on the front wing to get that scoop some fresh air. We're not going totally into uncharted territory.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you look back, you know, into the CART days with the big horsepower engines, you know, they were doing it on steel brakes even.
yeah.
So, you know, there were a lot of road courses they were going the same speed we're going, you know, 190, 200 even, Road America, and getting the thing stopped with steel brakes. So we got to look at the economies of scale as well, right? Right now we're taking carbon brakes and asking them to do three or four races, which maybe isn't ideal if we're going to ask even more out of the brakes. You know, the steel situation, you'd go through two sets a weekend, right? Practice on a set, race on a set, you know, maybe carry one of them over into the next practice weekend for a bit. So, you know, the steel is going to be disposable. The carbon is just so expensive that, you know, that we're, as teams, we're really looking to get a couple of events out of them. But, you know, it's one of those things where if you do overheat them and damage them, and now you've got a degraded set of brakes that you're trying to carry into another race or two, and it, you know, it impacts your results. So we got to look at that as a series and figure out what the best balance of that is. But knowing this far in advance is great.
All right, we've got about 15 minutes left before we need to get you back to work here, Mr. Bretzman. So I'm going to bounce around a little bit with some questions. And we just coincidentally have answered a lot of questions that have been asked through the conversation so far. Let's see. Let's go to Norm Nelson. He says, for those of us that haven't seen an IndyCar in person for many years, what parts of the suspension are made out of metal and which ones are composite / carbon fiber? He said, when we see suspension failures, is that normally a metal part bending or composite parts breaking? And this one comes up somewhat often, Eric, and I think it's down to IndyCar's choice to cover the front suspension with carbon fiber fairings, possibly being mistaken as the suspension pieces themselves being carbon fiber.
Right. The structural portions of the suspension are all steel. The control arms, push rods, toe links are all steel. What you may be seeing in photos is a composite kind of airfoil-shaped cover that's larger than the tubing that's the structural bit that's on the inside. Those are two parts, kind of like a clamshell design that cover the suspension. And they do actually serve another purpose besides the airfoil shape. We run wires for wheel speed sensors and upright temperature and brake temperature. We run the hydraulic brake lines down the control arms. You know, they have to get outboard from the tub somehow, and they'll actually live outside the steel arm, structural arms, but inside the carbon fiber cover. You know, 15, 20 years ago, we would have run the hydraulic brake lines actually in the steel.
Oh yeah,
control arms.
Such a pain to route as well. Such a pain to route.
Yeah, and you know. We think we've got a safety feature built in now, right? When if you were to, say, brush the wall and bend a steel structural member, you haven't necessarily pinched a brake line or cut one of those internal brake lines, right? So when you come to the end of the straightaway with a little damage, you still got brakes to stop, right? You're not going down the runoff. Or, you know, the big important one is when you come into the pit lane with your damaged car and hit the brakes, you don't mow your own pit crew over, right? So you know you've got brakes when you get back in the pit lane. So I think that there, you know, that's been a safety feature of these covers too, is getting those hydraulic lines out of the steel tubing. Yeah, but it's more parts, a little more expense. It does save you from having to roll exotic steel cross sections, and building the suspension up that way. So there's a couple of good things to it.
Bobby Rooney, I love this question. Eric, can you compare and contrast both the driving styles and the in-race mental strategic approach of Alexander Rossi and Ryan Hunter-Reay? What is the single biggest strength of each at this stage of their careers? I'm always fascinated to hear, you know, folks from someone who's closely embedded with drivers like this, just more of the what makes them unique or special. So what do you think on driving styles and that mental approach between the two of them?
I would say it's hard to pick right now. They're both on top of their game. I mean, it's really cool to watch them every week. Alex has been to some of these tracks twice now. Brian's been to some of these tracks a lot. I would say the biggest difference is probably in practice, to be honest. Like, Ryan's knows what he's looking for. He knows, like, the last, hey, remember that time in 2012 we set it up like this and it all went pear-shaped? Or remember that time we set it up like this and it seemed weird in practice, but it paid off in the race, right? He's got a huge database of that to pick from. So I would say the biggest difference is probably in just the race prep and car setup side. And Alex is going through that stage of, I'll do whatever it takes to be fastest, right? So, you know, you got to be careful you don't get burned a little bit, right? Where you just get too aggressive and the track gets too hot or the pack gets too big, right? And the car gets too loose or something, right? Like, you still gotta help them along there with, kind of dialing in the expectations a little bit. In the race, holy cow, I don't know what to tell you. They're both just going for it. Like, I mean, Ryan wasn't sitting back at Detroit, that's for sure. Like, he was a second a lot faster than everybody. And, you know, we've seen what Alexander's willing to do, right, at Indy and Phoenix and some of these tracks. And we know he can run a perfectly clean race, right? We look back at Long Beach and just, it was, you know, perfectly clean race. Like, just nailed it. So I would say when the race starts, they're both in good position. I would say that the difference we've got right now is, you know, just Ryan's got a ton of experience.
Let's continue on this quickly before we get to one of the final questions, Eric. So you've been with the team for a little while now. You've obviously gotten a chance, gotten a feel for Rossi's capabilities now, what, 2.5 years into his full-time IndyCar career. What do you see with him in terms of headroom for improvement? If we look at what he's done just the first half of the 2018 season, I mean, holy cow, this kid's making a statement that he is a future champion, but do you still see some headroom for improvement there so he can't, you know, there's even more ability to become like that Hunter Ray with that huge database?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, I talk to the guys here about it all the time. They're probably sick of hearing it, but every week we have to show up and be in top five. Like, if we're going to win the championship and win races, we got to play up front every week, regardless of the shape of the track, whether it's raining, whether it's dry, whether it's whatever. And Alex has really put his mind to that this year, I would say. You know, talking about his finishes, you know, Detroit race two being his worst finish of 12th, that's, you know, that's going a long ways.
That's not, if that's your worst, you have to be, you're not happy, but you got to be happy.
Yeah, I think that's such a big thing, right? Like, it's not always going to be your weekend, but sometimes you're going to be running second or third and somebody's going to give you the win, right? So I think that's the goal, I think, across the board for all our guys, particularly him. But I think he's just going to be learning from, you know, his experience on some of these tracks, just getting back there for a second and third time finally. I think that's, it's going to be a lot easier for him now going back to Highway. It's going to be a lot easier for him going back to Gateway. Heck, he's racing against people that raced Gateway the last time IndyCar raced at Gateway. Right? There's people with a lot of miles at Gateway, and he just showed up and ran it last year. So I think there's I think he'll quickly catch up to the others. Just, you know, once he gets third or fourth time returning to a track.
I'm still taken back to, I think, Christmas of 2015 and a somewhat random email that showed up from Dale Coyne, which was a photo of Alexander sitting in one of Dale's cars in the shop, posing with Dale and Honda Performance Development Vice President Steve Erickson, and, you know, some little caption of, you know, what we want for Christmas or something along those lines. And again, this is nothing negative against the Coin team, but it's just fun looking back. You know, wasn't so long ago where he's trying to get into the series, wasn't sure where he was going to land, might have been a Dale Coin option. But to see that, you know, he ended up signing with Michael Andretti and Brian Herta, that Indy 500 win last year, making, as we've spoken about, a very, very bold statement after knocking off Dixon at Watkins Glen, which we kind of hadn't seen before, and then the kid being on just a tear this year. You know, if you are a fan of driving talent, I don't know if we knew what to expect about Rossi coming back from Europe, because we didn't get to see him in good Formula One machinery. But clearly, F1 is missing out on something and someone that, with a couple years, you know, 2.5 years of IndyCar experience, is already scaring the heck out of a lot of folks who, you know, maybe weren't anticipating having to beat him to get to the title. So just a general appreciation for how much he has done in such a short amount of time.
I think everyone's missing out on a lot of guys, to be honest, right? They just kind of put them in, give them a little bit of time, and spit them out. you look at how good some of the guys have gotten over here after 3, 4, 5 years. We definitely have some guys that could compete over there, but they just run them through the mill so fast over there, it seems.
Let's see. Let's get to last question or two. We already spoke about Texas a little bit, but maybe we can drill down a little bit deeper with this question from Robbie Berggren. He says, "Hi, Eric. How hairy is Texas going to be with the high temps and the wind anticipated this weekend?" Let's talk a little bit about general tuning outside of aero. So we've already, you know, spoken about the maximum rear wing angle, which is tilted back pretty darn far. We've got the diffuser sidewalls off. We've got the reverse wicker that we mentioned trailing on the floor to take downforce away. If you're painted into a somewhat narrow box with aero tuning tools, how much can you do through the mechanical side, Eric? And how busy can you be during that opening practice session to throw whatever it might be, toe, camber, etc., springs, anti-roll bar changes? I mean, what's the mindset going into that opening practice? Is it lots of aero tuning, or is it, ooh, we're bringing everything that's metal to pit lane, and we're going to swap it out as quick as we can?
Yeah. Think big in the first session. It's going to take some big swings potentially to get it dialed in with the time we've got. We are going to be aero downforce, I guess I'd say downforce limited for sure. It's not going to be easy flat. So I think we're going to have to focus on keeping maximum downforce around a lap, right? So that might kind of fix your ride height targets a little bit. And then that's going to kind of lead you into your spring and ride, static ride height package to try and keep the car in the right spot as much as possible. Then it's going to be about getting your wedge right. Kind of working on the weight distribution, diagonal weight in the corners to keep it underneath them on corner entry. Texas has now become super interesting with the two different ends of the track. Banking wise, it's always been interesting because it has different warp characteristics rolling from the straight to the corner and from the corner back to the back straight. So there's some interesting things we'll be playing with springs and bars there to try and make certain things happen. But I think we just got to take big swings. You know, we've got a kind of a new tire as well this year, so we got to figure out what it's going to take to make that thing tick where it makes its most grip, and balance the sections of the corner out. So I think you're probably going to have to, you got to keep the rear behind them. So that'll be goal number one. And then however far into making the mechanical setup complementary to what you have with the aero setup is where you're going to end up.
I'm telling you, my man, I am so thankful I transitioned years ago from being a race engineer to doing what I do today, because Texas sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It'll be fun.
I know. I mean, again, engineering, well, racing in general is problem solving, but from the aero side, the mechanical side, keeping the tires under the thing, people passing one another, high lane or high line, low line, etc. Yeah, this is going to be different than the years where cars just had lots of downforce piled on. Everybody was nose to tail and went around in circles until things got ugly and people crashed. This sounds like it's going to be one of the bigger challenges of the year for those inside the cars and those on pit lane, those in the timing stands. But, again, that's one of the things that I think makes us love IndyCar. It shouldn't be easy, and it demands the entire team to excel in order to come away with a victory these days.
Yeah, certainly. There could be a lot of pit stops. The drivers are going to want a lot of new tires.
Keep them fresh. coming from Firestone. Mr. Bretzman, thank you again, my friend. And I'll look forward to seeing you here in 95 to 98 degree weather in Texas. And we'll see what we have to talk about after Saturday night. Thanks again for listening to the Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. We'll speak to you next week.